This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson. And if you've got clear skies tonight, you're in for a treat. The peak of the annual Perseid meteor shower is expected to be even more brilliant than usual. According to NASA, the number of meteors streaming through the sky could be double the norm. Joining us via Skype with more is Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Jeremy.
And tell us more about the Perseid meteor shower, first of all.
So there's this comet called Swift-Tuttle that goes around the sun every 133 years, and the comet's nowhere near us, but this time each year we pass through its orbit, and the comet has left little bits of debris all along its orbit. We plow through those, they hit our atmosphere at 37 miles per second, and we get a bunch of meteors. It's really that simple.
And it lasts for how many days?
Well, the peak is tonight, as you mentioned, but the Perseids is a good meteor shower because it lasts for a week before or afterwards. So if it's cloudy where you are tonight, don't worry. You'll see them tomorrow night or the night after that, and no problem.
And why is this year expected to be so amazing?
You know, as this comet goes around the sun, Jupiter occasionally comes nearby and in its orbit, and it nudges some of the particles so that they pass a little bit closer to Earth by about a million miles than they otherwise would. And a couple of meteor specialists, dynamicists, have predicted that we could get a pulse because Jupiter was near this stream a couple of years ago, and they're just now getting to Earth's vicinity. It could be good for that matter. And also, every time the comet comes near the sun, it lets out a big burst of these particles, and these hang around in space for a long time. So a different set of predictions suggests that we could be getting some leftovers from passes of the comet like centuries ago, and we just happen to be going through the right place.
So when and where should people go to get the best view?
Yes. Well, this is actually quite a general thing. That we call these the Perseids because they appear to radiate from the constellation Perseus, which rises over the northeast horizon by about 10 o'clock. So anytime after 9 or 10, after it gets good and dark, you might see a few. The later you can stay up, the better it will be, the more you will see, and also the moon will set around 1 a.m., so that will help too. And the point is you can find these anywhere in the sky. You don't have to look in one particular place. The darker your sky, the more meteors you'll see, and generally the best place to look is wherever your sky is darkest, which is often just straight up.
And you say stay up late. Would it be better to get up really early?
You know, it actually would, or just, you know, party all night long and then whatever, because as we get closer to dawn, the meteors hit us more straight on. Perseus is almost nearly overhead in the sky, and that gives a little more punch for each one of them. You know, for every bright meteor you see, there'll be a whole bunch of faint ones. So again, darkness is really the key here.
And if you don't see any meteors, which is unlikely, at least you still can see right now in the sky Mars, Saturn, and Jupiter.
Absolutely. Those are and Venus, if you're really quick right after sunset. These are all in the evening sky. Something to think about while you're waiting for the meteors to show up would be to do some planet watching.
That's Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope. Kelly, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Jeremy. Clear skies.
And of course, Sky and Telescope has a lot of great stuff at their website. We'll link you to that at hereandnow.org. And there's a NASA live stream of the meteor shower. We'll put that there as well.
It's Here and Now, and we've been listening to Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton lay out her economic plan, child tax credits, closing the carried interest loophole. How about we get back to summer and Ali Benjamin's beautiful young adult novel, The Thing About Jellyfish. It's a finalist for the National Book Award last year about a friendship between little girls that starts to unravel as they hit double digits. There's parental divorce, bad behavior by Susie, and an even heavier topic that kids might want to talk to their parents about. But Ali Benjamin then adds science, specifically jellyfish. Did you know there is one jellyfish whose bite is so venomous that victims beg their doctors to kill them and get it over with? We spoke with Ali Benjamin about The Thing About Jellyfish last August and asked her how she came to combine Susie's story with jellyfish.
I had been working sort of off and on this novel that wasn't quite taking hold, about a girl and her brother. And separately from that, my kids had a day off from school, and we decided to go to the New England Aquarium. And we were in the touch tank room, which is where you can touch sharks and rays. And we went downstairs to the jellyfish exhibit, which was just wonderfully, perfectly quiet. And we stayed there for a really long time just looking at these jellyfish through glass. And I was really entranced in a way that I had not expected to be. And I wanted to learn as much as I could. I started reading articles. I started reading magazine articles and newspaper articles and even online academic journal articles. And the more I learned, the more fascinating I thought jellyfish were. And so I started writing about them, not really sure where I was going with it. I was originally thinking that I was writing adult nonfiction. And then a lot of the themes that were coming out in that were really similar to the themes that were coming out in the story I was writing about this girl. It was like these two stories were walking in parallel. And then one day it hit me, like I had this light bulb moment where I realized I was writing the very same story. And that's when the novel really started to take off.
Well, you talk about seeing the jellyfish, as Susie does. She goes to the aquarium and wanders off into this room. And it's stunning to see them through her eyes. Strange creatures, tentacles finer than hair, changing color, like alien ballerinas who danced without needing any music. I mean, graceful aliens. So she has the moment that you did.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another moment. We learn early on that her best friend, this girl she'd been so close with, her mother informs her that Franny has drowned. Right at the beginning, we have a young woman confronting death. Fill that in a little bit, who these two girls were. A lot of women are going to get that. Almost how you fall in love with your first best friend when you're young.
That's right. And our best friends, our first best friends, are often the very first people to break our hearts. When they were in elementary school, when they were in the single digits, they were as close as anything and they didn't need anything else. But at their core, they were two really different people. And they got to middle school, they got to sixth grade, and you start to see these differences emerge. And they continue to try to work it out, but they're growing in very, very different directions. Franny is a lot more social. She's much more of an extrovert. She wants to have a lot of different friends. Susie is awkward and thoughtful and very nerdy, and she loves facts and she loves science, and she connects with ideas and facts much better than she connects with people. And they just start to get pulled apart in the way that so many of us have had friends that we were pulled apart from at that age.
It's heartbreaking because later in life they may become your best friends again because, you know, Susie is extraordinary, but she constantly talks, I'm just going to tick off some of the things, you know, about how rabbits' teeth never stop growing, or they cannot throw up and they will eat their own, you know, or how there are 60,000 miles of blood vessels in a single human body, enough to circle the earth, or there are now so many jellyfish that power plants around the world have been shut down when hundreds of thousands clog their seawater cooling systems. She is the kind of child that, again, when you're a little bit older, you will so appreciate, but at that age, kids don't.
Right. She's got a ton of incredible qualities, but they aren't the qualities that shine in middle school.
Darn it.
Right?
Well, and I'm wondering if this book might go a little way towards maybe shifting that a little bit, because you also turn her into a young detective.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she is handed this information about her friend. And by the time her friend passes away, they've already had a falling out. They've already had a really big falling out and feels tremendous guilt about the way their friendship ended. And then she's handed this information. And like any of us, when we lose somebody, we don't know what to do with it. It feels like it can't be real. It feels like the world owes us a better explanation than the one we ever get. And we want to do something. We want to undo the fact. We want to somehow make things right that weren't right. And her mom says, sometimes things just happened. Mm. And for her, that's not an explanation. That's not good enough. She wants more.
Well, it's funny because we're going to have a book down the road, a nonfiction, very scholarly book called The Spiritual Child. And it's about how there's this innate need in children to seek this kind of spirituality and talk about things. And the mom in this book does exactly what you're advised not to do. She cares so much about her daughter, but shuts that spiritual search down, again, by saying, well, some things are just meant to happen. And I don't want to give away too much. Susie goes off and is determined to find the answer to what happened to her friend Franny. She thinks it has something to do with jellyfish. How did you get inside this 12-year-old mind, the magical thinking, the really, really risky behavior to maybe try to find an answer?
It's a really good question, and it's not one I think I have an answer to. The answer is I really don't know. I know you interviewed Elizabeth Gilbert not that long ago, and she talks about ideas being like viruses that are outside of us that just, if we're lucky and if we do it at the right time, they just kind of flow through us. And there's all kinds of stuff I look at now and I kind of scratch my head and say, I honestly don't know where that came from.
Well, yeah, because it's just sometimes so wildly out there what Susie does. And again, we're not going to tell you, but is this also, while being a book for young adults, is this also a book for adults? I read it that way, to kind of try to get inside the head of what a child might do when they're in pursuit of an answer to something.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of us as adults are still processing what happened to us as kids, and we're still processing some of those big, scary things that are out in the world that, you know, here we are, we're the adults, and we don't have the answers. And we do lose people, and we don't have the answers. And there are really scary things happening in the world, and we don't have the answers. And we're the ones who are supposed to be guiding the kids. It's funny you said that about her mom doing exactly the wrong thing, but her mom didn't have the answers.
Right.
Her mom was grieving this child's loss. I mean, what worse thing than to have your daughter's friend pass away? What worse thing than to have a child in the community pass away? And her mom is grappling with everything just as much as Susie is. Everybody's kind of fumbling around in the dark and nobody has the answers. And so nobody can really guide her in a meaningful way. So she sets off on her own quest, and it's this last act of friendship. She wants to make it right for her friend Franny.
Ellie Benjamin, what do you hope happens when young people read the book?
That's a great question. One of the things that has happened to me since I wrote this book is I'm hearing a lot of people's middle school stories. This book seems to bring back people's middle school experience in a way that's really visceral to them. And so a lot of people are coming up to me and they're talking about what they were like in middle school and what they went through in middle school. And the really interesting thing to me is that it seems like everybody was walking around feeling like Susie. Everybody was walking around feeling like they were on the outside looking in, that the fun was happening elsewhere. And I think there's something so beautiful and so tragic about that idea, the idea that everybody's sort of moving past one another and not able to connect. And I think there are kids out there who feel that way right this very moment, and maybe they'll read this and feel like they connected with someone. And because the book does deal with some of the bigger issues, it does deal with losing someone you love. Maybe years down the road, somebody will remember this book and it will give them a frame of reference for sorting through all of these unfathomable things that we go through when we lose somebody.
I'm just realizing, too, that in middle school, you are like jellyfish. Everybody's just floating by everybody else. They don't connect and they don't know how beautiful they are.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I love that.
Ellie Benjamin. Again, the book is The Thing About Jellyfish. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
Oil prices have been low for some time because of a glut in oil global markets, around $44 a barrel today, up from a low of $27 a barrel earlier this year. But that glut may be ending. The International Energy Agency predicting today that global production of crude will fall behind demand by almost 1 million barrels a day. Joining us now is business journalist Ali Velshi. He's in New York. Hi, Ali.
Hello, Jeremy.
So what's behind this news that this glut of crude oil on the markets may be ending?
Well, what's happening is, the buyer for most crude oil are refineries that refine it into a usable product. And what we're seeing is the refineries have increased their buying and processing. They're all running at capacity, which is an unusual way of determining that demand must be up, because refiners wouldn't be refining oil into petroleum and diesel and other things like that if buyers weren't buying it. So there's a combination of demand going up and non-OPEC production, like from Mexico and Canada and the United States, going down, and that's leveled out supply a little bit.
So we talked about the price. It's $44 a barrel-ish right now. That's higher than the $27 low. It was more than $100 a barrel in June of 2014 and more than $150 a barrel back in 2008, right before the financial crisis. What can we expect to happen to prices in the coming months?
Well, you'd normally think with output low and or lower and demand higher, you'd see that price go up. But there's an interesting thing that happened when oil prices got as low as they did in the 20s and 30s, and refineries didn't want that oil, people started storing it. There are tankers out in the ocean right now just sitting there with oil. Now the refineries are taking that oil. So they are moving the glut out of storage and making that into gasoline. As a result, you're not seeing a call for more oil to be pumped, and that's why you're not going to see an immediate increase in the price of oil, or at least a commensurate increase in the price of oil, probably for some months. It may be after September, once that glut has been cleared out, that you start to see an increase in the price of oil, assuming everybody doesn't start producing more.
And do you expect everybody, including North American producers, to start producing more?
Well, that's not what the U.S. government predicts. They feel that structurally Mexico, Canada, and the United States have become accustomed to these lower rates. You know, until oil gets to about $57 a barrel, it's not worth fracking, for instance. It costs you too much money. So we're not going to see a ramp up until we look like we are sustaining oil at $60 a barrel or more, in which case other producers will get in on the game and then probably stabilize the prices.
So I don't know about you, but I have never bought a barrel of oil, but I do buy gasoline. So what does this mean for gas prices?
Well, for now, gas prices are going to largely work on normal demand. Refineries in the United States are producing as much gasoline as they've ever produced. As you know, we're in the summer driving season, so demand is high. For the moment, they don't look to be any reason for spikes or drops in the price of oil. I think we're looking for about 3 months of steady.
And what about the stock market? Because we have noticed that as oil prices have gone up and down, it has impacted what's happening on Wall Street.
Yeah, look, Wall Street's got a whole bunch of things going on. The stock market's actually doing relatively well. What Wall Street worries about with oil prices is that oil drops in price or spikes can sometimes cause economic effects. As long as there's stability for a while, you're not going to see this play out in stock markets in any meaningful way.
Okay, another global energy story I want to ask you about. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan met this week for the first time since Turkish jets shot down a Russian warplane in November, and they're promising to move forward with some energy projects. Tell us about that.
So the world has changed a lot since Turkey shot that jet down. That was over tensions with Syria. All of a sudden, two things have happened. One is Russia doesn't have Ukraine available to build new pipelines. Russia supplies a great deal of Europe's gas. Turkey, below the Black Sea, is the other logical option. So they want to build a pipeline through Turkey to get to Europe. Turkey has had this coup. They've had a real crackdown on free speech and politics and things like that. Europe is cracking down on Turkey, so Turkey needs a good friend. But the concept of a NATO country, Turkey is a NATO country, chumming up with the biggest threat to NATO at the moment, which is Russia, is very worrisome to Europe. But Turkey gets a lot of its energy from its neighbor Russia, and they're trying to mend fences.
It's also worrisome to Azerbaijan, isn't it?
That's right, because they would like Europe to get their natural gas in particular through them, and they'd like to be the transit point. So Turkey and Russia stabilizing their own relations is proving destabilizing to a number of countries in the region around where Asia and Europe meet.
Is it likely that this is going to impact oil markets around the world? What's happening with the pipeline?
Well, no, because it's not even clear the pipeline will get built. This sounds like the two of them expressing a desire to get it done. This does seem to be a little more political than it's anything else. It's the idea that Turkey shot a Russian jet down, so they've got to look like they're making peace. They want to start talking about greater energy partnerships. It's par for the course of the way Russia has been doing business since Ukraine. So I don't think anybody needs to get too worried about it yet, but NATO's got to keep a good eye on this and maybe have a sit-down with Turkey and say, look, are you with us or you're not with us?
That's business journalist Ali Velshi. Ali, thanks so much as always.
Always, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.